Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love, coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where our guest today is Chris Whitaker, the author of We Begin at the End, which is a number one indie pick, a Barnes & Noble book club selection, and a Book Reporter Bets On pick. I had the pleasure of interviewing Chris back in September for a bookseller trade event, and our conversation was so much fun that I've been looking forward to talking to him again since then. He's joining us today from outside London, where he lives with his wife and three young children. Thank you, Zoom, for bringing us together. I usually have an author start out by telling me about his book, but Chris, you have this wonderful backstory on how you became a writer. And it starts back when you were 17 or 18, the morning after the night before, and it's a crooked line from there. So let's start there.
Okay. I've been looking forward to this as well. I must point that out. So I'm going to take you all the way back to school age me, who was a bit, kind of got into a lot of trouble, didn't take my studies seriously, didn't apply myself. That's what my parents would say. I was studying for my A-levels, my kind of university entrance exams over here. And I got really drunk before my economics exam and got so drunk that I woke up in hospital and missed the exam and failed, obviously, because they, it's not a valid excuse. It's really, that's what my parents were very disappointed as well at the time, and they told me that, and I get that. I'd worked two years towards this and kind of threw it all away, but it didn't end up mattering that much because I didn't know what I wanted to do. My friends knew they wanted to go to university, knew what they wanted to study. They had a life plan. I was without a plan. I was aimless back then. So I left school, bounced from job to job, had some brilliant jobs, actually. I worked in a bakery, which I love. That was one of my favorite jobs because we got to take everything home, like the cakes and things that didn't sell on the day. I just took them home and ate them. So I really enjoyed that. And then I did some bar work, sold some electrical cabling. I had so many jobs. And then I was working as an estate agent, a real estate agent, kind of like an office junior. And I was out dropping leaflets through people's doors in London, quiet morning. And someone came up to me and asked to borrow my phone. And my gut feeling was, this is a strange request. I know how this is going to go. I'm a Londoner. People get mugged all the time. I'm going to get mugged. So then he asked for my wallet, and I didn't want to give it, obviously, because I was 19. And when you're 19, you're fearless. And so I put up a fight, and we had a fight, which was fairly evenly matched for a while. So I was doing okay. And then he pulled out a kitchen knife and stabbed me in the side a few times. And it was really really hard, actually. I didn't realize I'd been stabbed, actually. I thought he was punching me. Because, adrenaline's going, you don't really feel the pain until a few seconds afterwards. And then I saw the blood kind of all over my shirt and everything. And I dropped my phone, dropped the wallet. He picked up both and ran off. And I got in my car. There was no one around, actually, at that time. So I jumped in my car and drove myself to hospital, which was really close. There was a big hospital right near. And they stitched me back together again. And then everything went wrong. I don't know if I was expected to get on with it, but I was kept being told that I was lucky, that it could have been worse, and which I know, but you also don't feel that lucky, when you're in that position. You feel like very unlucky, actually. You feel like, I'm just going about my business. Mm-hmm. And that's the way life tends to go sometimes, isn't it? There's good people and there's people that do bad things, and that they seem to collide all the time. And then everything went wrong, and I didn't know about PTSD at the time. And so I was shell shocked. I thought, what the hell is going on? Why can't I eat anything? Why can't I drink? Why can't I read a book? Why can't I watch TV? Why can't I exercise? Why can't I do anything at all? Just nothing is helping, nothing is working, nothing is the same as before. I'm not the same person. Something has changed, something, fundamental, something critical has gone wrong inside me. And I didn't tell anyone about it because I'm terrible at that. I'm terrible at asking for help when I need help. I still don't do it now. I'd rather do everything myself. I'm getting better at it. My wife encourages me, you know, she continuously asks me if I'm okay and things like that, because I think she worries. But so I took on all this, you know, this kind of trauma myself, and told my parents I was fine, told my girlfriend at the time that I was fine, but I wasn't fine. And it got to the point where I started hoarding painkillers, because I thought, I'm going to take a load of them, and that will be my way out of this mess, you know. At least I won't have to get up every day and carry on kind of living this life that I don't want to live. So I sat down, and I was going to write a note to my parents. I was going to tell them, it wasn't like an apology or anything, I was just going to say, this is how it is, and it's my life, and I choose, you know, not to live it anymore. That's my choice. You can't live a life for someone else, you know, because they'll be upset, which sounds callous, but that's how I felt at the time. And I'd got a book from the library, and it talked about this technique that you can use, where you take the traumatic incident and you write down, you know, you write down what happened, but you change the people involved to fictional characters. So you change where it happened, the outcome, everything gets changed. So it's not you anymore. And I wrote Duchess, the character in We Begin at the End. And that was 19 years ago now. Wow. And she kind of appeared on the page close to fully formed. You know, I had this strong idea of what she looked like. She was this small girl, vulnerable, wearing old clothes, wearing a kind of cowboy hat. She looked like a victim, you know, the sort of kid that gets bullied, the sort of girl that has a lot of problems. And I started writing her, and I felt a bit better, actually. I don't know if it was just distraction at the time, you know, just having something else to focus on other than the way I was feeling. So I went to bed that night and slept for like 6 or 7 hours, which I hadn't done since it had happened, you know. And that's, sleep deprivation is a tough thing. It is, you know, even when you've got a new baby, like we've got a 7-month-old, and just, you know, a few days of no sleep and you start to not feel like yourself, you know, you can't concentrate on anything. So I was doing okay. I carried on writing these. It was disjointed what I was writing. It was just scenes, you know, a scene that I wanted to write. So it might be a bar scene where Duchess gets into trouble or is protecting her mum or something. Nothing ran together. There was no forethought or planning, or I didn't think this is going to be a story, you know. It was just therapy. Mm-hmm. And then I, probably a year passed, you know, just writing little bits and pieces, getting myself back together again, and before I gave some thought to what next. And I knew I needed to find something, you know. Everyone had a career at that point, my friends were on their paths. And just by chance, I picked up the newspaper and saw an article about a stockbroker, and he had a Ferrari and a beautiful wife. And he was living in Spain, in Marbella, and it just looked like paradise. And I thought, this is the life for me. This is, you know, this is lovely. So I went into the city, you know. I thought, I'm going to be a stockbroker. I didn't know how. I didn't even know what a stock was, let alone how to break one. But I went into the city and I managed to talk my way into a job. So I found someone, you know, that I think they took pity on me when they saw my CV, and they gave me a shot. And I did the whole client entertaining thing, you know, where you go out to strip clubs and things like that. And I really enjoyed it. So there's one in London. I'm going to go off topic a little bit. There's one in London called Stringfellows, a famous strip club. And I was in there so much, I befriended all the girls in there, and they came to my wedding.
I love it.
I know. So it was like the back row of the church. There was just a line of dancers in their best dresses, and they're so much fun. They are my friends, you know, to this day. And so I was working in the city, doing well. I had a handle on things again. Things were okay. And then I dreamed of working on a trading desk. It was like the ultimate job. You know, you take the company's money and you invest it, and you don't have to deal with any clients. You're right kind of at the front end. And the rule was, so my boss said to me, if you lose $20,000, you stop trading. We'd sit down, talk about what's happened, what went wrong. And the next day I kind of went in ready to do it, ready to make my fortune, and lost $2 million pretty much straight away, and didn't tell anyone. One of my friends worked in the back office. So I said to him, let's keep it quiet. Like Nick Gleason did many years before me. I said, let's keep it quiet. I'll make it back, which is ridiculous because I didn't know how to. So I lost a bit more. And then it started to get really serious. And then I came in one morning and everyone was waiting for me in a boardroom. You know, there were lawyers, there were the bosses, everyone was sitting around, and I thought, you know, this is it. And that was it. And they had all the figures in front of them, and they said, we know what's happened. We know everything. And they could have gone to the police. You know, they easily could have, because what I'd done was, you know, I'd broken the law. I didn't mean to at first, you know, I just don't think I was aware of how serious it was, you know, and I was very young and naive, and that's no excuse, you know, that I'm sure a judge wouldn't care, you know, if I went in there and said, I'm young and naive. Yeah. But I'd started to make money, you know, I started to get the hang of it, and I was getting better at being a trader and making money for the company. And they said to me, if you pay back half of it out of your own pocket, we won't go to the police and you can carry on trading. And I signed the contract there and then, and I went home 24 years old with $1 million of debt. And we were getting married, my wife and I at the time.
Strippers
in the back row of the church. And I didn't tell her, obviously, what had happened, because I like this image that people had of me, that I was young and successful, mm-hmm. and someone to be proud of. I like that my parents were proud of me. And, you know, I'd messed up at school, but I'd made amends for it. And, you know, I was, yeah, a son worth having, kind of worth being proud of. And I like that perception. So I said nothing. And the wedding costs were spiraling because of that perception, because I was doing well. He can afford it. He can afford a nice honeymoon. So it was a horrible time. And so we would be looking at churches in the day, and I would be checking the terms of our life insurance policy in the evening. That's how bad it was. Uh-huh. And I thought, I don't want to leave it with nothing. You know, I'm going to make sure everything's okay. And I was there again. I was right back there. You know, I'd spent so many years leaving that version of myself behind, you know, kind of afraid and didn't want to look in the mirror. And I was there again. And I went back to Dutchess. I went back to Montana to writing, you know, on our honeymoon. I'd sit down there while my wife was asleep, and I'd write about this girl that was struggling, and I'd kind of project everything onto her. You know, however I was feeling, she was feeling, or she was dealing with something, you know, that she couldn't cope with. And that helped, and that got me through it again. And writing without doubt kind of saved my life for a second time. Mm-hmm. And then we came back from honeymoon, and I got on with, you know, making the money back. I just worked really hard for many years and paid it all back and got myself out of the mess that I'd been in. And then I was coming up to my 30th birthday, and I'd been working in the city for about almost 10 years. And I read a book called The Last Child by John Hart, which I love. One of my favorite books. Is like a masterclass in crime writing and mystery and page turning suspense. And it was so inspiring. And something in me, you know, it just clicked. You know, I thought, this is what I want to do. You know, I want to write a book like this. This is the life that I want. You know, this is the life that I should have had. This is what I should be focusing on, because writing is the only thing that I enjoy. Mm-hmm. And I read an interview with John Hart, and he had a similar story without the trauma. He had, he had been a lawyer and stockbroker, and he had quit basically because he wanted to be a writer, you know, and people thought he was crazy. And people thought I was crazy because I did the exact same thing that very day. I went into my boss's office and said, I don't want to do this anymore. I quit. And Victoria, my wife, was pregnant and a student as well at the time. So she had no money coming in. And she was stressed when I got home that night. We sat up till the early hours working out a plan. But she was supportive, you know, she knew that I wasn't happy. And I think she didn't know about this story until not that long ago.
Wow.
And I think she kind of sensed that something was off or wrong, or, you know, that I wasn't happy and I was struggling. But again, I never asked for help. So it's hard it's hard with someone like that, I think. I'm aware of it, but it doesn't make it any easier to change. So we went, moved to Spain, sold our, we had a nice apartment, nice car, sold both of them, changed our lives completely, changed our lifestyles. All the security was gone, you know, overnight, everything that I had built up and it was kind of gone. And we lived in Spain for a while where I wrote my debut novel, Tall Oaks, because I didn't want to write We Begin at the End. I didn't want to write that story. It felt like it was mine, you know, and it was not to be shared, and it wasn't done. And I didn't even know if it could be a book. And I wrote Tall Oaks, and then we went, came back to London, and I got an agent and publishing deal. And Tall Oaks was nominated for an award. In the UK, we have, like, you have the Edgar Awards, mm-hmm. and we have the Dagger Awards, the mm-hmm. equivalent. So it's a big deal here. And there's one up there.
Yeah,
so you can,
exactly.
tell, you can tell where this story is going. So we went to this fancy black tie awards dinner thing. And there were all these big name authors, Sunday Times bestsellers, New York Times bestsellers. And there was me with this book that had not sold very well and hardly anyone had read. And then they called out my name and I'd won. And it was strange. So I hadn't prepared a speech. I didn't even bother because I thought, there's no way I'm going to win. So I went up on stage, forgot to thank everyone, just thanked my wife, took the Dagger Award back to our hotel. And then my wife just burst into tears. And she, you know, it just, I think it hit home then how hard it had been for her, mm-hmm. you know, to live this kind of life alongside me. And yeah, and that almost brings us up to now where we are. And just poetically, I know that you saw I did an event with John Hart last night, but a while ago, John Hart read We Begin at the End, you know, probably a year and a half ago. And his quote came in, you know, and that was a special day when that happened. It felt like I replied to his email and I really wanted to tell him that he probably helped save my life because I don't know where I would be. But I felt that was a bit much for a first email to someone that you don't know. So that's where we are. So that's the story.
That's the backstory. And you know what's really interesting is you almost ended your life. You ended your career. It's We Begin at the End. Think about the title mm-hmm. of the book. And I didn't put it all together till now. And we'll get into the title more later. But it's really, you were at the end so many times. And it's sort of like the book brought you back. The book saved you writing.
It did. In so many ways, you know, not just because I was going to do something really drastic, but just, you know, it's made me a different person. It's mm-hmm. made me happier. And I care less now about, you know, looking successful and what people might think and less, not in a horrible way, but less about my parents' version of my life, you know, the life they might have wanted for me, yeah. you know, and they didn't know about this story until there was a version of it in The Guardian and they read it and that's how they found it. That's how they found out. So
now they constantly ask you anything you need to share, anything you need to tell us, anything you're holding back.
I think they're scared to ask that question in case there's more.
In case there's more. Anything else you didn't share? Is there anything else we need to know? Because we have to tell our friends too. But just, I love the Ferrari part because it's like, oh yeah, that's going to be my life. That whole thing is a movie. Okay. That whole thing is Brad Pitt getting out of the car. Okay. Just be perfectly clear. Perfectly clear. I could see the movie. You know, Duchess is such a brilliant character. She's so tough, but she's filled with so much sadness. At the same time, lots of longing. She's missing branches of her family, literally. She doesn't know where her family tree. Yeah. And I was thinking of Scout Finch with a Stetson when I was reading her. Mm-hmm. And was she always written to be that bold and be that girl that was in your face?
No, not really. Not at first. She started off quieter. She started off just someone, I suppose it's because I was writing it when I was going through that. I just put all my problems on her. You know, I just made her unable to face anything and quite timid and quiet and just wanting to be normal, basically, because mm-hmm. that's how I felt, you know. And I take it for granted now that I find, you know, just getting up and breathing and being normal, mm-hmm. You know, kind of effortless. And I still clearly remember when it wasn't. And that's, you know, that's always there in the back of my mind, that the chance that it might come back and something like that, you know, or something might trigger it and I might feel like that again. But it's been so long now, I feel okay. But Duchess, I wanted to make her tough, you know. So this image I had of her, you know, where she was like a victim, she was still carrying a gun, mm-hmm. you know, in my mind. There's this girl that looks like a victim that looks like this, but she's obviously, she can you know, she can deal with things. She can find, she might not do it in the best way, but she will find a way, and she'll, yeah. And she's, she also swears a lot, doesn't she? She curses.
Yes, a lot.
Yeah. And some people are really bothered by it.
That's so her.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, I just loved writing her. You know, I just, she was such a great character. You know, it was heart-wrenching, some of the stuff I wrote, because I knew how the book, I knew how the story was going to end. And I knew at the beginning, her mum talks about selfless acts, and that's what make you a good person. And I knew Duchess was going to spend the book looking for her selfless act, and that when it came along, it was going to be a tricky one,
to write. It's going to be tough for her. Where did her name come? Because I was thinking this morning, Duchess in the UK is royalty. So where did her name come from? Like, was she always Duchess along the way?
Yeah, no, it's a strange one, actually, because my grandfather was a big Johnny Cash fan, and I grew up listening to a boy named Sue, and I named her with that in mind. I thought, you know, because he names his son Sue, so he grows up tough because he's going to get bullied, you know, and Duchess, that's where that came from, you know. She just had no chance at all.
Yeah. And at the same time, she's broken. She's got the spiral. She's in a spiral of being broken, trying to get out of it. She's also a really brilliant caretaker to her little brother, Robin, who is 5 years old. And she guards him like he's a baby bird. And I was thinking of his name as well. It's like she wants him careful in the nest. She's constantly looking for him. Is that name too is perfect? Am I right there?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. That is absolutely perfect. Yeah. And she... yeah, I loved the name Robin for him, because I really saw him as this small, you know, thing that needs, you know, he doesn't see himself that way, and he's quite bolshy, and he will speak his mind. And, you know, there's a point where Duchess does something dreadful and he really lashes out. And it's quite hard to read, because it's difficult, you know, for her, because he is all that she's got and all that she cares about. And if she feels like she's done wrong by him in any way, you know, it just ruins her. It really does.
Well, you know, she fights everyone. She fights her grandfather, Hal. She fights the boy, Thomas Noble, who likes her at school. It's like she doesn't know how not to fight. Like, she doesn't know how not to do it. And it draws me back to the time that you were in the fight on the street and how that affected you. And dare I say, the mugger should only know what he inspired. I mean, he should, like, if this guy is out there and you look the same, it's like, wait a second, I was the mugger. I was the guy who mugged this person somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
Seriously, it's like a crazy Never story.
I haven't, no, but I think I'd have another go. I really do.
Exactly, here you go, go for it.
I definitely wouldn't. No, I would, yeah. I think I'd just throw my phone and wallet at him.
Exactly. Take it. Here, go. No problem.
If there's anything.
But then we might not have the book. You know, there's so many damaged people, the book, and people with regrets, and all the regrets tie together. So let's talk about Walker, who is the police chief in the town. He's sort of like the guy who never left the town. He also never grew up. He did something when he was 15 that had ramifications on everybody from there. So let's talk Walker.
Yeah, I loved writing Walk. If Duchess is perceived as the darkness in the novel for some of it, Walk was like coming up to clear sky. You know, it was like he is on the surface quite simple. You know, he wanted to be a cop his whole life. He wanted to get married. He wanted to have children. Some of that stuff didn't work out, but he is a policeman in the town he grew up in and this town that he loves. And he was always going to be the anchor to Duchess. You know, he keeps her pointing in the right way. He's like the moral compass, you know. She'll look to Walk and he'll remind her what is right and what is not right. And she would never admit that. And she would never admit that they have, you know, they kind of have this beautiful friendship that plays out over a year in the book. And I really enjoyed writing it. And it's never overtly spoken about, you know, how much they care about each other. And they have a few, you know, scenes that I really enjoyed writing. So a character dies and there's a funeral and they have this scene together in a barn and she just tells him to go. And she won't acknowledge the fact that he really cares. Mm-hmm. You know, she just won't let herself believe that. But he clearly does, you know, and he's at some points he is all she's got, whether she wants to see it or not. And her mother's aware of that. You know, she they sit on the beach. She's a childhood friend of Walk, and they sit on the beach together, and she tells him, you know, Duchess needs you. You're the only person that she looks up to, because she doesn't look up to me. Mm-hmm. And that was quite hard to write, you know, a mother feeling that way about a daughter, but it is quite right. And Duchess needs him. And I wanted her to have someone like that in her life. He's such an important character in that story. He really is.
And he is, especially since we know where she is. She's not in a good place. She needs him, and he's moving to a bad place. He has this illness that he's definitely spiraling quickly with what's going on. And he's not well, and he has regrets. He's got regrets over what he did when he was 15 with his friend that sent their all lives together. So he's trapped in a way. So he's trapped while she's trapped at the same time. And I find that the juxtaposition of him being good, her being the little, you know, rebel, it was such a good juxtaposition of the two of them, but they were both trapped in what they were doing. And to break out was going to be, can you even do this?
Yeah. And he, a lot of the time you think he can't do it. And there's a trial. I won't give anything away, but there's a trial at the end of the book, and he does something surprising, you know, which kind of shakes Duchess. And and that was, I gave a lot of thought to that, you know, because I knew where they were heading and I knew what was coming. And it was, has he got that in him? You know, has he got that in him to do that? And he's kind of tragic, because he has this version of himself that he looks back on, like I did, you know, before things went wrong. And you wonder if that's, you know, rose-tinted glasses, if you're really seeing, you know, was everything easy? Was everything perfect? Or were your problems and troubles just different or less magnified? But Walk sees, you know, the 15-year-old version of himself, everything was okay. He had his best friend. He had a girlfriend that he still loves to this day in the book. And he can't get past that. So he clings to it, and he tries to preserve this town that they live in. You know, he tries to keep it exactly as it was. He resists every effort to change it or improve it or build new housing. He will vote against all of that just because he can't cope with it, you know, that it's slipping away and he might not be able to get it back again. And it is literally slipping away, the town, because it's eroding, you know, it's on the edge of a cliff. And every so often the ocean comes in and just takes one of these houses. And it was very, you know, metaphorical of Walk losing, you know, parts of himself.
But, you know, she's so tough and rough, yet you love her. And it makes me think we need to look inside people before we decide who they are. Like, you really have got to sit there. And I'm on this track of when you're watching her and you're watching him and you're seeing their internal monologue, like, you know, played out on the pages, because you know what they're really thinking. I'm realizing that so many times we see somebody and we go, oh, that's what's going on with them. And you could think about if she's a kid in school and she's mouthing off and blah, blah, blah. And the teacher goes, that's a bad kid. But they're not seeing what's really going on to look inside. No. And I see that she makes you think.
Yeah. And I think the world is like that, isn't it? That, you know, especially with social media, you know, I do it for the book stuff and I enjoy it and I enjoy hearing from readers. But occasionally you'll see someone tweet something that they obviously hadn't thought through, or they it can be taken in the wrong way, or they've misspoken and they just get crucified. You know, everyone piles on and it's very unforgiving, you know, and I choose to see everyone as good. You know, I like to see that. I like to see the good in people. I like to believe that people are innately good. And all the characters in the book, you know, there is no black and white with any of them. You know, we're all more than the worst things that we've done, you know, all of us. And it's how bad those things are, and how much everyone chooses to focus on those. That's how much of a chance I think you have to leave your mistakes behind.
Yeah, just keep on going. You know, the book defines genres in so many ways. It's a crime novel. In fact, it's funny because the first week we do this thing called Bookachino Live, where we talk about books that are coming out and books that we're excited about. And my editorial director moved it into thrillers and mysteries. And I was like, no. No, that's not what it is. It's fiction. It's just fiction. And he's like, no, it's classified as mystery and thriller. And I'm like, really? And I'm like, oh, okay. Like, I see that as what's going on in the book. But it was really funny because it's also coming of age. Do you define it? I mean, it's one of those books where you shelve it. You could shelve it. I always felt stories should shelve things in more than one place. Let's just start there. And let's put it every place it's supposed to be. And actually, I told the CEO of Borders that years ago and actually sat down with him at Book Expo and told him that this was going to be a really good idea. And he told me why they could never do it. Because then if the promotion moved, they wouldn't be able to find the books. And I was just there like, really? Really?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I do it at the library. I work in the library and I do it with my book. I shelved it in crime and I shelved it in general fiction. Mm-hmm. And it was borrowed by different people with different expectations for the story. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting. And it was borrowed a lot more in general fiction. And the feedback was really good. Whereas someone seeking out like an out and out crime book, you know, it's not that book. It's, I didn't set out to write that book. I didn't set out, you know, it's the last thing I consider. The genre that I'm writing, I was very aware that we're having a look at a year in the life of a girl, 13-year-old girl and a police chief, and that's all we're doing. And things happen in that year that might push the book in certain directions or the story. But you can't, it's not easy to categorize. And I was really relieved that my publishers gave me that freedom, because they sometimes, you know, they might balk at the suggestion that, you know, a crime or a mystery novel can be driven by a 13-year-old girl, you know, because it's a tough thing if you don't get it right, you know, if you it just won't work. And they let me do that, and I've been so lucky, you know, with Amy Einhorn, my editor. She's just so skilled and, you know, one of the most talented people I've ever met, and she kind of saw I delivered a book, but it wasn't this book. You know, it was a rough version of that book, but it was nowhere near the story that I wanted it to be and thought that it could be. And she got me there.
You know, when there's an editor who deserves their reputation, she's definitely one of the editors who does, because earlier this year, we interviewed Alex George, and Alex George actually talked about how Amy gave him a suggestion for the ending that had to have him go rewrite the beginning of the book. And it was the right ending. And it was this big buildup at the end, but you had to go back and do everything. So I've seen and heard like little things along the way that if you just do this, this is going to be a bigger book and it's going to work differently.
Yeah. So, and she does it in a way so it doesn't feel like it's a huge change. Right. You know, it's like a suggestion but it's so insightful. And it's just, I think it's just an ability to read people and, you know, read characters and read situations and see what they would do. And yes, it's a real skill, you know.
And it's also to work with the author. So the author still feels it's their work, good about that they own it, they feel good about it. There's a change that's not going to feel unauthentic to the author. And that's really important, because when there was a book a couple of months ago that someone had said they edited so many times and whatever. And I was like, yeah, and it needed one more to like hold it together, because it was choppy. It was all super choppy. And you just don't want to have the book be super choppy. And the smooth is really tough to do.
It is. It's the hardest thing about writing a book, the pacing and just getting it right. It's the thing that I imagine is hardest to teach, you know, if you go and do a course or something, or a writing course. I'm sure there are rules and things, but you know, it's got to feel right. It's got to, it's kind of a flow, but it's more than that. It's just, I suppose it's wanting to stay in the world that you're creating, you know, and you want your reader to not want to put the book down.
Yeah.
But do that without it being, you know, an incredibly fast paced crime thriller that where you have to know the twist at the end. And I think editors are skilled, aren't they? They bring out
really super skill to be able to do that. I also remember from our prior conversation that the book is set in California and Montana. You haven't been to either, but what drew you to set the book there?
Initially, it began with moving the setting, you know, for that therapy kind of type thing. It was moving it a long, long way away from my life. So that got me a few thousand miles away. But what carried me to America was, I suppose, the draw to write a big story on a big canvas, you know, and especially this story, you know, I had this, the towns were carefully planned and I wanted it, the California town, to be on the coast, and I wanted it to be eroding, and I wanted it to be idyllic. And And then I needed this, on the flip side, I needed this huge open space of Montana, you know, for the characters to be able to breathe, and for Duchess to be able to breathe and take some time to look around, you know, at the world around her, because she's so focused on Robin. She misses everything. She's missed her childhood, misses growing up. But for Montana itself, I was, my most treasured childhood memory is Disney, going to Disney with my dad, because my parents divorced when I was quite young. And I missed my dad a lot, you know. I'm very close with my dad, and he took me and my brother to Disney, and it was just the best time we had. And we were in the line to go on one of the rides, and there was a family in front from Montana, and they were talking to us, and they just painted this such a beautiful picture of this place. And the dad said, this guy said, it's like switching from portrait to landscape, which I loved. And that's the line that made it into the book. And one of my friends, another author, went to Montana not that long ago, and he said that same line to me. So I'm wondering if they got it from somewhere. You know, is it out there? Is it the Montana Tourist Board? Because it should be, because it just, in my mind, describes it so perfectly. And just before this podcast, I was talking to a journalist for the Montana Press about it, and it was just really interesting. It was, he thought that I got it right, which meant a hell of a lot, actually. Yeah, it really did.
I was thinking of Nicholas Evans, another Brit who set his book in The Horse Whisperer in the United States as well. I believe it's in Montana. It's Wyoming or Montana. I can't remember which one. I actually wrote him this morning. They had a broken character, and I told him to get your book. And I said, yeah. Nick, I think you'd really like this one. The landscape definitely draws people in. So did you, like, just look at books about the landscape? Did you have Google Maps up at the same time?
Yeah, that's how I do it. It's a lot of it's done at the library. You know, I read endless books and travel guides. There's some brilliant, really big travel guides, really detailed ones. But I also found this book that is just pictures of scenery in Montana and seasons. It takes you through the seasons, and it just seems to get more beautiful every page that you turn. Mm-hmm. You know, it's Montana in winter is spectacular, and then fall, and yeah, it's just I'm dying to go there. I really am.
Well, I confess that my husband and I recently watched the Yellowstone series that is set, right, the television series that's set in Montana. And I turned to my husband, I mean, we've been, like, you know, home for like a year now. And I said, I really want to go to Montana. I want a ranch. And I said, I want a helicopter, because I just want to be able to say this line. Take the chopper, the car will take too long. Like, I just want to be able to say that line out loud.
I think you should be able to, Carol, as well. I think you should say it.
Yeah. It's my version of Ferrari. It's my version of Ferrari is the helicopter.
Yeah. I mean, look how well it turned out for me. Just go for it. What can possibly go wrong?
What could go wrong? I'm just going to go write a book. So now, eventually, you will go to California on tour, and you will go to Montana on tour, because you've never been to either place. It'll be really fun.
Yeah, I can't wait, actually. And I'm racking up bookshops that I need to visit when I'm over there.
You know, exactly. You can take the chopper from one to the other.
I'm going to borrow it. I'm going to come to your ranch and borrow the chopper. And it'll be much quicker.
It is very funny, though, because I just said to my husband, it's like, and then I'm saying, wait, we really like to cook. Where would we get food? Like, I've actually thought about this over the last couple of weeks. And I said, it's kind of pitiful. This is what my life has become. The ranch in Montana, but I can't get sriracha sauce. You know what I mean? This is really bad.
So can you just go on vacation? Can you go and visit? Is it a long way?
Yeah. Can go visit. It'd be fine. We'd fly. But yeah, we would definitely do that. When you can get on a plane again and, you know, do all those things. Like, people are going to have to remember how to leave the house, you know, leave and go places.
So are you locked down at the moment?
We're not, but, and I do go places. In fact, it was really funny when you were telling the story about the strippers. I was really laughing. I do go out and I get a massage, and this guy is also a personal trainer. Mm-hmm. So I really am fascinated by people's lives, as I bet you are as well. And you want to know, like, so I said to him, when you're a personal trainer, I said, what are most of the people that you're training? He goes, they're strippers. And he told me this, like, whole story about stripper culture and whatever. And what I find is, if I didn't ask, I wouldn't hear. Like, what is your life like? And there's so many people that just don't do that. And I feel like you gave us a window into Duchess, and you gave us a window into Walker, but you wonder if people in the town really knew them the same way, because you asked the questions that you then wrote about them on the page.
Yeah, undoubtedly they don't, you know, especially with Duchess, you know, that she is just someone to avoid if you're a kid in her school, or to laugh at if you're one of the popular girls. And I think we all went to school with, you know, some kids like that, that obviously had something going on at home and a tough time. But you're a kid yourself at the time, and you don't think to ask those questions. And thankfully, sometimes teachers do, and they have people to look out for them, but often they don't. And yeah, and I did some research into, I can't talk about it because I'll ruin the story, but I did a lot of research into Duchess's character and her journey and where she ends up with Robin. And it was, some of it is very difficult reading.
How long did you work on the book? A couple of years?
How long?
Well, besides, you know, years ago when you were 19, but.
About 4 years.
4 years. Yeah. For everybody who thinks it's like 20 minutes, it's 4 years. It's
I mean work. I don't mean like pick it up, put it down. I'm a 7 day a week writer. You know, I put the hours in, and I don't sleep very well in general. But when I'm writing, especially with this book, I just don't sleep. I just lie awake worrying and thinking, you know, is this the absolute best that I can do? Is this the best story that I can tell? Is this the best paragraph? Is this the best sentence? Why doesn't this word fit? You know, it's a level of detail that I choose to go into when I'm writing. And I think the reward at the end is, you know, the payoff is there, because at the time I couldn't have written a better book. You know, now I might pick up the book again and flip through it. I don't do that because I know that I'll start wanting to change things or think, why did I do this? Why didn't I do that? And it's maddening.
No, the writing is so good. And we can't talk about the ending, but it's so well done. And I'm going to quote from our reviewer, Joe Hartlob. He's like one of our top reviewers. He's been with us, company will be 25 years this summer coming up. He's been with us almost the whole time. He says, reading the last quarter of the novel may take a little longer than normal, because you will want to digest the exquisite plot twists that go off like a string of explosives, moving backward through the book and forward past its conclusion. And I'm sharing that with you now because I think it's really about, there's a real resolution of life. And did you have that ending in mind at the beginning?
Yeah. I knew where it was going. And because of where it was going, you know, because Duchess is searching for this selfless act, it made some of the scenes harder. And it made, because you get to know them so well, you know, it's quite a big book. It's a lot of words. And by the end of it, you feel like you know Duchess very intimately. And I knew what was coming, and I knew there would be feedback from readers, you know, about what had happened. And I didn't think I'd get so many messages as I've had, but I take that as a positive, because it means that people care. You know, I've done my job properly. You know, I'm writing to entertain people, but I want them to give a damn about the characters and where the stories are going, and want them to want Duchess to get the ending that she deserves.
Exactly. You know, I've heard you say that book openings matter to you so much, you start at the middle, and you don't start with that opener. So you were somewhere in the middle of the book before you wrote the openers?
Yeah, so I was probably chapter 4 or 5 or something like that. I just go straight in. You know, if I feel like writing a certain scene, I'll write it, then put it to one side, then work out where it's going to go later. It's disjointed, and it makes it difficult. You know, the first draft is a mess. I don't let anyone read the first draft. No, it would be unrecognizable as a book, let alone as this book. It wouldn't read like a story. It would read like perhaps a set of scenes, you know, just plucked randomly from the air, you know, that don't run together. But there is a lot of pressure on the start, you know, especially with the Amazon free pages that people can read, you know, and you've got the pressure to hook everyone. And it's a lot, isn't it?
We build websites for authors, and often I'll say to them, put up the excerpt you want. Is it necessarily the beginning? Because a lot of times the prologue's up there, and the prologue's not going to be what everybody needs. It's there, but that's not really where it's going to end up happening. You know, the title comes up, and this is my galley where I like fold down the pages and do all those things that you, this reason I don't get library books, because I fold down. So I get galleys, and this is the reason I don't like eBooks for galleys, because I fold down and write and things like that. The title of the book comes up again and again on the pages, and I'm always so proud of myself when I'm reading a book. I go, oh, there it is. There's the title. Then I go a little further. There it is again. So it comes up throughout the book. And I'm like, wait a second, didn't I get that back there? And I'm looking at the folded down pages, and I'm right. Was it always the title? Was this always?
It was, It was the title of the prologue. So I had a prologue and I just put We Begin at the End at the top in the hope that it might get used as a title. But my editor luckily plucked it out because I don't like Tall Oaks, and my second book was All the Wicker Girls. I didn't name either of those. And this one I didn't. I called it Book Three. Mm-hmm. You know, when I'm writing it, it's Book Three, or it's just called Book. And it felt so right and it really fit, but it's not a crime title, it's not a mystery, you know, it's probably more general fiction, you know. Mm-hmm. So I worried that they would give it a crime title, you know. Mm-hmm. That didn't really fit it, just because that's what people are expecting, and that's, you go into the crime section, you might not pick up We Begin at the End. Mm-hmm. You know, you might want something with a crime term in it.
Well, that's the reason the cover really works too, and I don't think anybody's really been talking about the cover, but the cover, mm-hmm, it evokes, I mean, dark, it's got dark and light. I'm seeing dark, yeah, and light. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing a trail going to nowhere. I'm like interpreting the cover, but there's light and there's brightness going. But it's not like, if you look at this, is this a crime novel? Is this general fiction? Is this, what is it? Yeah. You know?
Yeah, I think they did an amazing job with it. Yeah, I really love it. It's a special moment, isn't it? When you see it for the first time.
Yeah. And it's UK and US have the same cover, correct?
Yes.
Same cover, which is very unusual. A lot of times it's very different.
Yeah, they've tweaked it slightly. You know, the font is great on the US one. You know, the way it leans kind of, and it's mm-hmm, beautifully done. And there's slight differences, but for the most part, yeah, it's rare, isn't it?
It is really rare. Yeah, and it's fun sometimes to see an author who's like sold into a number of countries, and you see all their covers up on a page, and you see how everybody reinterpreted the same book for their market, like who they think it's going to be able to sell to.
It's been fascinating for me because, mm-hmm, since January, it's sold in like 14 countries around the world, and that's just in the last few months. And the German cover came through, and they're sticking roughly with it as well, which, mm-hmm, I love. The French cover is very different, but still beautiful. It's like Duchess, it's a girl's face, you know, and it's very nicely done and very French and very stylish, and you know, they've done a good job. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see as they come in. I love to see them. I like it when they send them to me as well.
When you, on your website, put them all on a page, put them all up because people can see, because I think they'd really love seeing the international. It's just really fun because it's how it got reinterpreted. It's the same book, you know. But then there's also the audio, and George Newbern narrates the audio. Did you have a hand in picking him?
They said that they could get George Newbern, and I did some research, and he's very skilled, you know, and very talented, and I jumped at the chance. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he was the only one that was suggested, and I think that they knew, my publisher knew, that he was going to nail it, and he absolutely did. Yeah. And I'm happy to defer in things like that. You know, they will send me, for the other books, they'll send me a list and a few different people reading, you know, other books, and they'll say, who do you like? We like this person, which means I should like that person as well. He's done such a brilliant job. He really
has. It's really, really, really strong. And so many people are listening on audio these days. People are out, we live on a street where everyone walks, like they just go for walks. I feel like I should get a dog so that I'll have a reason to go walk. Like with her.
Yes.
There are a lot of little puppies out here. I mean, I know that they're little puppies and everybody bought a dog in the last couple of years, but everybody's walking and listening at the same time. They're listening to podcasts, listening. It's very interesting. You have no formal writing training. Were you always a reader?
Yeah, since I was a kid. Yeah, massive reader. I would choose books over the television when I was a kid, which my kids would never do. They would choose the PlayStation or something like that. And I grew up reading books that I shouldn't have read. You know, when I was a kid, like my dad was into Stephen King and used to shelve them really high. And they were like these fascinating things to me. You know, why can't I read this? What's in it? It's just a book. I didn't realize that books could be so terrifying. And so, and he's, you know, the best for a reason, Stephen King, you know, the characters, you know, he's the master of writing character, you know, characterization. He's just so, so good. And I read It when I was about 10, we used to go to the library and I would run off and grab a copy of it and I'd put it inside a comic book. I was one of those kids. And I'd sit there kind of terrified, you know, really scared reading this, you know, not wanting to turn the pages, but needing to know what happened to Eddie and all the other characters. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. He wrote in The Stand, there's that scene in the Lincoln Tunnel where all the cars are and people are walking above them. So I used to drive into the city every day for all these years. And I would only think about that scene. Like, oh my gosh, the cars are going to get stuck in here. This is what's going to end up happening. And I met him at an awards event years ago. And I said, just want you to say, you stay in my head. And I always want to walk through the Lincoln Tunnel now. And he goes, well, you know, there is a time you can do this. Like there's a race or they close the tunnel. And I'm like, oh my gosh, Stephen King and I could walk through the Lincoln Tunnel, you know? That's my remembrance. That's other people are going up. I really love your work. I'm going, I get to the Lincoln Tunnel and I think of you. Okay. All right, there you go. So are you reading differently now, like thinking about what authors do with their books or?
No, it still hasn't, you know. Yeah, I never look for a twist. I never look for anything like that. And I never, you know, I'm more forgiving as well. If I read something that I don't like, I'll try and understand why. You know, and I know how subjective, and I love how subjective reading is. You know, I love that there's a reader for every book in the library. And I love how some people will hate one of my books and love another one of my books. I like that. And but yeah, I read widely. Yeah, now, especially being at the library, but I get sent a lot of books. I'm really lucky to get sent, as I imagine you do, a lot of books.
Just a few.
And they're always pretty much exclusively crime books. So whilst I love reading them, it's nice to branch out a bit, read something different.
Yeah, I do own ones that aren't blue. These are just to keep the background. Like I do, these are all the blue ones in the house. No,
and I own some that aren't mine. I should point out.
Just have your book all over the house. Yeah. Come on, come in, take one here. I have a little cash register at the front door on your way out. And, the Ferrari's coming, you know? You know, for this book, you were seeking blurbs. And I can see now that people are going to start requesting them from you. Like they're going to sit there and say, you know, you've written under pressure. And it's like, you know, the pressure of at the beginning to tell a story, and then it's a pressure to get the book out. Are you enjoying how you feel right now?
Yes and no. Okay. I am. I feel disconnected slightly because I'm so far away. You know, I was supposed to be in New York in a couple of weeks, and that's been pushed to May now, to the end of May. So I'm missing it a little bit. But, you know, getting to talk to you helps massively, helps bring me back into the world. Yeah, I am. It's been, it feels like a debut, you know, it feels like that everyone is kind of pulling and together and to make this, to help this book to reach as many people as possible, you know, and I'm so grateful. And I struggle with that thing, you know, where you don't feel worthy and you don't, you know, you don't feel like you deserve it. So yeah.
No, it totally works. And I think that what this book is going to be a big word of mouth book. I think this is going to be something people read and say, you've got to read this. You've got to read this. And I think that kind of a build is going to happen on it as well. You know, a lot starts here and it goes like here and then there, like it just does it. And I just see that it's the kind of book that you're going to want to talk to somebody about. I mean, I said to my husband, you have to read this because I keep talking about it, but because I can't tell you. So you have to go read this now. And he's like, okay, I'll have another night. Last week he was reading Mark Greene. He goes, great. I was up till 3 o'clock in the morning. Thank you very much. And I said, hey, doing a good job. That's what I can say, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's a BNN pick, the Indies pick. And now there's film news that was announced this week. And it's kind of interesting that we go back to Disney.
We do Disney go back World, to Disney.
As far as the book. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very exciting. It had this mad time where I was working in the library at the day and Zooming with Hollywood Studios in the evening. It felt surreal again, like this whole journey has been. But I found the perfect partners, you know, I found the perfect fit. Tommy Cale, the director of Hamilton, which I thought was a masterpiece, you know, I'm a massive Hamilton fan. I thought they did something so special with that. And they just get the book, you know, Disney just really got it. And it started, with a, who I thought was just, I won't name him, but I thought he was just but I thought he was a book blogger on Instagram, but it turns out he is the buyer for Disney. So, I thought, oh, it's lovely. This guy really likes the book and he's got a lot of followers. And I thought, this is great. And then he was in the meeting, the Disney meeting.
I've seen you posting about me.
Yeah, I'm just so grateful. You know, sometimes it feels like you need a bit of luck. You need the right person at the right time to read your book. Mm-hmm. And
it needs to be the right time in the world too. Mm-hmm. I mean, a year ago, it would have been more difficult to get somebody to concentrate and pay attention. And really, as much as this feels nutty now, it was really nutty last April. Yeah. When I sit there and think back, a couple of weeks ago, Winter Institute, the ABA's, the American Bookseller Association, had a conference, and they did a film of highlights of the last year. And by the end, I was like super choked up. And I don't usually do that because you realize how crazy the last year was for booksellers and how crazy it was that you're making split second decisions on what you're going to do. And they're going to impact your business going forward. And like, we gave up our office in New York because there was no reason to have an office in New York and re-sign in other ways. But it was all these things that were happening. And I feel like we're in a different place now where there's going to be a new normal. It's going to be something. We don't know what it is, but the book has a good place now.
Yeah, I think so. And I'm hoping that we will come out of it and appreciate the little things a bit more.
Yes. It's the little things that really are going to matter. It really, really does. So when you're not writing, you are working part-time in the library. We've alluded to this. What do you do at the library? What's your role?
I do a bit of everything. My favorite thing is baby rhyme time. So all the babies come in with their mums, and I sit at the front with someone else, and we sing nursery rhymes, and they try and climb on us. and it's so silly because you're not allowed to touch them. You can't, you know, they want to dance with you and stuff like that. And there's all these ridiculous rules and stuff. But it's so much fun. So I do that, and I do just general library duties, you know, shelving and, you know, helping customers, things like that. And I really love it, but it's getting harder and harder to maintain, you know. Mm-hmm. I have no time, and I need to write a new book. And I don't know how much longer I can keep working this much, because the balance is skewed a little bit, you know, between family. You know, I don't have an awful lot of time at home, and I feel guilty about that. And half of being a parent is just guilt, isn't it?
Totally. Mine are 26 and 31. I still feel guilty about things when they were three, you know. Yeah. I can recount it and they don't see it the same way, which is really funny, because I brought things up and they're like, no, that was like totally cool. Don't worry about it. I'm like, and I'm thinking it's damaging, you know, my gosh.
Yeah, I think that all the time. And I think, I'm not there to read bedtime stories as much as I should be, because I'm writing them instead.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was working really long hours. I was in the city. I was not home for dinner a lot of times and stuff like that. And I said to them, like, how did you feel about that? And they said, but we got to go to the Harry Potter event as a special guest, and we got to go interview these authors, and we got to get books in advance. And I'm there like, oh, see, there was something that, and you don't really think about it.
You don't think about what you're providing. You just think about what you're missing or what you're not providing. You
know? Yeah. And I think that this last year has been a lot about that, of people really evaluating what really does matter, what matters, what you really have to keep thinking about. Have you seen somebody check out your book yet?
At the library?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I make them all the time. You don't get out the library. If my books are in stock, you won't get out the door without taking one of them.
Up the circulation. We need more books of mine in the library. I love it.
You can't go into the library at the moment, so you do this, you fill out a form online, and you say what style of book, what genre you're looking for, then we choose some books we think you will like, and obviously everyone gets my book.
It's like, oh, it's on the shelf, yes, this will fit, you know. Cooking, there's something about cooking in there, don't worry about it, you know. But so it's like they have a celebrity librarian. They have a celebrity librarian right now, you know, there you go. So you are working on something. I remember when we talked in September, you were, we don't need to know what it is, but you were working on something then. Is that the same thing?
Yeah, it's the same thing. Yeah, and it's supposed to be delivered at Christmas, but whether that happens, we shall see.
A version will be delivered at Christmas, the title.
You get an email at Christmas saying, I need another few months. But it's a big one. It's another big book. It's another, there's a mystery at the core of it, but it feels like a big, big love story. Yeah, that's how I would describe it.
Well, I look forward to reading it. I look forward to that so, so much. I enjoyed this book so much. I've been telling everybody about it. I'm hoping to get a book club to be doing it, because it's one of those books you can discuss from so many different angles. Yeah. And I wish you so much luck and so much, you know, and happiness. I really hope that you come to a point where there's some peace in you, because it's really, you've done a fabulous job. And it's like, just pat yourself on the back, because you did a really great job.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us. And to our readers, look forward to seeing you next time. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from We Begin at the End by Chris Whitaker, narrated by George Newbern, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Macmillan Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. Thanks to our research assistant, Rachel Smithline. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from We Begin at the End, narrated by George Newbern.
Walk stood at the edge of a feverish crowd, some he'd known since his birth, some since theirs. Vacationers with cameras, sunburn and easy smiles, not knowing the water was stripping more than timber. Local news set up, a reporter from KCNR. "Can we get a word, Chief Walker?" He smiled, shoved his hands deep in his pockets, and looked to thread his way through when the people gasped. Fragmented noise as the roof caved and crashed to the water below. Piece by piece, the foundation lay crude and skeletal, like the home was no more than a house. It had been the Fairlawn place since Walk could remember, a half acre from the ocean when he was a kid. Taped off a year back, the cliff was eroding. Now and then the people from California Wild came and measured and estimated. The stir of cameras and indecent excitement as slates rained and the front porch clung. Milton, the butcher, dropped to one knee and fired off a money shot as the flagpole leaned and the banner hung in the breeze. The younger tallow boy got too close. His mother pulled his collar so hard he tumbled back onto his ass. Behind, the sun fell with the building, dissecting the water with cuts of orange and purple and shades without name. The reporter got her piece, seeing off a patch of history so slight it barely counted. Walk glanced around and saw Dickie Dark, who looked on, impassive. He stood like a giant, close to 7 feet tall. A man into real estate, he owned several houses in Cape Haven and a club on Cabrillo, the kind of den where iniquity cost $10 and a small chunk of virtue. They stood another hour, Walk's legs tired as the porch finally gave up. Onlookers resisted the urge to applaud, then turned and made their way back to barbecue and beer and fire pits that waved flamelight on Walk's evening patrol. They drifted across Flagstone, a line of gray wall, dry laid but holding strong. Behind was the wishing tree, a major oak so wide splints held its limbs. The old Cape Haven did all it could to remain. Walk had once climbed that tree with Vincent King. In a time so far from now, it too would barely count. He rested a shaking hand on his gun, the other on his belt. He wore a tie, his collar stiff, his shoes shined. His acceptance of place was admired by some, pitied by others. Walker, captain of a ship that did not ever leave port. He caught sight of the girl moving against the crowd, her brother's hand in hers as he struggled to match her pace. Duchess and Robin, the Radley children. He met them at half run because he knew all there was to know about them. The boy was 5 and cried silent tears. The girl had just turned 13 and did not ever cry. "Your mother," he said, not a question, but a statement of such tragic fact the girl did not even nod, just turned and led. They moved through dusk streets, the lull of picket fences and fairy lights. Above, the moon rose, guided and mocked, as it had for 30 years. Past grand houses, glass and steel that fought the nature, a vista of such terrible beauty. Down Genesee, where Walk still lived in his parents' old house, onto Ivy Ranch Road, where the Radley home came to view. Peeling shutters, an upturned bike, the wheel lying beside. In Cape Haven, a shade beneath perfect might as well have been black. Walk broke from the children and ran up the path, no lights from inside but the flutter of television. Behind, he saw Robin still crying and Duchess still looking on, hard and unforgiving. He found Star on the couch, a bottle beside, no pills this time, one shoe on and the other foot bare, small toes, painted nails. "Star," he knelt and patted her cheek, Star, wake up now. He spoke calmly because the children were at the door. Duchess, an arm on her brother as he leaned so heavy into her like he no longer held bones in his small body. He told the girl to dial 911. I already have. He thumbed open Star's eyes and saw nothing but white. Will she be all right? The boy's voice. Walk glanced over, hoping for sirens, squinting at fired sky. Could you go look out for them? Duchess read him and took Robin outside. Star shook then, puked a little and shook, like God or death had hold of her soul and was wrenching it free. Walk had given it time. 3 decades had passed since Sissy Radley and Vincent King, but still Star slurred about eternalism, the past and the present colliding, the force spinning the future off, never to be righted.
Thank you for listening to this clip, provided to you by Macmillan Audio. To hear more, look for this title wherever audiobooks are sold.